Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have another guest who is well known to most of our listeners, Catherine Lopez, who has been a longtime editor at National Review. You were very important in really carving out National Review online.
It seems like ancient history now, though.
Well, you know, welcome.
Thank you for
joining us. But you know, a lot of our readers go over to National Review and have been longtime readers of the website as well. Stanley Kurtz once told me that The Corner had it was one of the very early conservative news websites that got amazing traffic.
Yeah, it was always amazing to me that the people who would be reading it and they'd write in, and I think Twitter has taken away from blogs a little bit because our writers used to have the conversations they have on Twitter on The Corner, and everybody wanted to listen in, and we got actually some of our great writers from The Corner because they were readers. You know, Andy McCarthy starts writing in. Stanley Kurtz really? Probably started writing in for all I remember now.
When did The Corner start?
It started, I'm pretty sure it started somewhere around the Florida recount, Bush v. Gore. I think it was somewhere in that.
Which needed real-time
updates. Well, and that, yes. I think, as I recall, that's when the website really took off. Clinton impeachment, a little before that, but and Jonah always had a following. Jonah was the original editor, and it was Jonah, right. Reading his column, Jonah Goldberg, in the very, very early stages, after it was, the first stage for all of our websites were... You just went on, and this is how you subscribe.
I'm on Twitter now, and I get David French say, "Boy, David's active on Twitter."
David is. It's
He's
amazing.
Out there. I don't know where he has the time.
Well, that's the thing. He is as prolific as in articles as he is on Twitter, which is kind of amazing. He was finishing a book manuscript when we were on the National Review cruise in December, and he actually manages to be productive. Twitter can kill a writer's productivity, though.
There's always more to see every 5 minutes.
Exactly.
So, Catherine, our topic, The March of Life.
Right.
What?
Well, first of all, I thank you. I savor every opportunity to talk about the March for Life during, the time period of the march, the weeks around it, because people will listen, first of all. And it is this remarkable thing that happens every year. I'm increasingly every year blown away by the numbers of young people, the enthusiasm of the young people, the fact that they really get it, like, they appreciate that the fact that they're alive, was a choice. It wasn't a given, and they're horrified by it,
And in spite of the tidal wave of liberalism, secularism, choice, and so on, this issue just isn't going away.
No.
And the march is going strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was 2 years ago, there was a blizzard and it was going strong. Robbie George says the greatest speech on pro-life philosophy, on the cause, was Father Newhouse speaking at the National Right to Life Convention. I forget the year, but First Things, if you Google it, anyone Googles it, it's on the First Things website. We shall not weary, we shall not rest. It's as if it's in the air when you go down in the March for Life.
I wonder if the Democratic Party hadn't shunned or exiled every pro-life figure it could. I think we have one congressman.
Yeah, who they tried to kill.
Who they tried to
Dan
kill?
Lipinski from Illinois.
Will he be there?
He'll be a speaker. It's
a lot of courage right there.
Yeah, the abortion industry tried to primary him out, he's a very courageous person, and I also applaud the pro-lifers who tend to be Republican, who always cheer him on and encourage him and have him speak at events and things, and who fought for his re-election too, actually.
If the Democratic Party hadn't gone all in
right.
on choice, abortion. Would the march of life be as big a thing?
I probably not. But I don't know. That is a really interesting question. The question I thought you asked was, would our politics be what they are today? I think things would look dramatically different. We wouldn't be as harsh as we are, for one thing. But we should have competition. There should be competition for the pro-life vote.
Indeed.
And it's really, really gravely unfortunate that it isn't. And I remember Archbishop Chaphew saying during an interview a couple of years ago, it always struck me, he said, if you had asked me decades ago which party was going to go all in for abortion, he was not going to say the Democrats because there were too many Catholics in the Democratic Party. Hmm. But there we went. It's one of those political examinations of conscience that I think Catholics in the United States need to do.
And if we jump over to the Republican Party, the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party was all liberal on this,
right?
Was all,
right.
all progressive in their terms.
And even, I mean, would you call Rudy Giuliani a libertarian? There's a lot of it in the Republican Party too.
Right, right. Well, how has the war, if there has been a war, between the pro-life and the pro-choice elements that are in the Republican Party, has that gotten more tense in recent years as the left, we could say, has gotten more aggressive? Mm. The Democratic Party has grown more vigilantly anti-pro-life, not just pro-choice, they're anti-pro-life.
Right.
Has that played out in the Republican Party in any interesting ways?
Well, you know, oddly, I think it was more hostile sort of, you know, inside baseball DC window before Trump. Trump surprisingly has been doing a lot of, quote, pro-life things, right? And so it's almost been like, I was on some TV show and someone sitting next to me called Donald Trump pro-life Christmas, which I think I probably reacted as you're not supposed to do on TV. I wouldn't quite describe it that way, but that's how they're feeling. That's how people are feeling.
Wait, they felt wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. He's saying all the right things, doing all the right things on when it comes to funding issues and yeah, the language is spot on in many cases. Of course, then the question is, what is the long-term effect of Donald Trump being your pro-life champion, right?
Well, Mike Pence was there last year.
So Mike Pence spoke the first year. Physically there the first year. Then last year, the president did a live satellite from the Rose Garden, and which was billed as like the first president being at the march, kind of, sort of. George W. Bush always phoned in, so it was. I sort of thought, but that having been said, he is all in on the March for Life.
We'll take it.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there is the long term question of what does that do to the cause after he's gone and whatnot. I don't know what the answer.
And this year will Mike Pence?
Mike Pence is speaking at the Rose Dinner after,
okay.
And I think at the moment we're taping this conversation, we don't know what the deal with the march would be.
I should go. If you go back to Trump, has Donald Trump's surprising respect for religious liberty and you know, fairly traditional Christian, you know, I mean, people on the left scoff at, oh, they're going to say Merry Christmas, wonderful. I actually put a lot of weight on that,
mm-hmm.
In fact. The symbolic values are important.
Right.
Has that emboldened the social conservative pro-life wing of the Republican Party? I mean, you say pro-life Christmas. Are they feeling?
Yeah.
I can go out and campaign on this a little more strongly than I did before.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it is no small thing when the president makes the March for Life an issue everybody has to cover it. That, you know, and frankly, the president phoning in, not everyone has to cover in the same way. And so, there is a re-energizing that you see. I mean, the energy is always there, but there's, you know, there's a difference between being a couple blocks from the White House and Barack Obama's there,
right,
and Donald Trump. And that's just the fact, whatever you think about Donald Trump on this issue. I mean, obviously the Supreme Court,
that's right. And Trump during the campaign, he came out and said that this the position on life will be a factor. Yes.
As Hillary Clinton doubled down, I think it was the second debate, my jaw dropped. There were people in this country who were looking for an excuse not to vote for Donald Trump, and if Hillary Clinton had softened her stance a little bit, you know, obviously people listening to this wouldn't have voted for Hillary Clinton, but it would have been smart politics to soften a little bit. And she didn't. She did the exact opposite.
My take on it has been that the Hillary of 2006 would have won.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I guess Barack Obama sweeping in 08 and being, you know, the hard left, I think she took a lesson from that.
Yeah.
I think she took the wrong lesson.
Yeah. Ultimately. No, I mean, everything, there's so many aspects of her. It doesn't come across obviously the same way. It worked to Obama's advantage in ways that it couldn't for her.
Right.
But.
Right. So with the march taking place, you expect equal or better numbers from last year.
Oh yeah.
No diminution of enthusiasm.
Yeah. No reason to expect otherwise. They don't actually have the march used to be on the day of the Supreme Court ruling, the 22nd, but now they do it on Friday because one year they had to do it on Friday and they realized, oh, more people come and it's just easier to do it at the skip school, the last day of the week rather than the first day of the week, and all the rest have more time to get home, spend some time in D.C. even if the weather isn't too bad.
And for people who are listening who might think of going at the last minute, where are they going to go?
You go ahead to it starts out on the Mall and they walk up to the Supreme Court. And some people just go to the Supreme Court. Some people frankly not the most organized of marches,
right,
in terms
right,
of
right,
people
right.
filing. But that's sort of the fun of it too, and the whole town, there are masses all over the place. You've got kids sleeping in church basements. It's also an interesting window into the Catholic Church because as the headlines are what they are, obviously, and those are realities in the church, this is the church too.
Right.
And there's so many, it's not just a Catholic event, but Our Lady of Guadalupe is everywhere.
And when people go there and they go to the Supreme Court, now you remember the images of the crowds coming to the Supreme Court when Kavanaugh was sworn in, the pounding on the doors and everything. Do they do that?
No.
They don't. No. Okay.
No, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because sometimes I'll go up to the Supreme Court early, and because there tend to be both prayer vigils, pro-life people doing prayer vigils, but then there will be counter protesters, and the counter protesters tend to be really, really angry, miserable, shrill.
Right.
I mean, one year, I kid you not, it sounded to me like sounds from hell. I mean, it was just, and it was all about, you know, abortion on demand with no apologies, and it was just, it was really heartbreaking, and but that tends to be the counter protest, and it tends to be rather small, but awful.
Catherine, what are they so angry?
What are they so angry about?
What are they so panicked about?
If your cause was this, you'd probably, there'd be some anger and real deep hurt, and I mean, it's something miserable about that cause, you know, especially, and that's what, that was the smart politics of Bill Clinton, right? Talking about safe, legal, and rare.
Right.
People don't
right.
like abortion, you know? And if you're waking up in the morning and this is your cause, that can't be that life-giving, right?
Right.
And
right.
So it doesn't surprise me that it's like that. But oh my goodness. Yeah.
If Roe v. Wade were overturned, abortion would not immediately be illegal, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
I mean, sometimes you have to tell people, this is not criminalizing
right.
abortion.
Right.
It now goes back to the states.
Right.
And that means it's back to the people. And the states will, you know, it'll be our federalism at work once
right.
again.
Right. So New York will look different than Utah or, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So
yeah, and this is an issue where most people have no idea, you know, on every level about the option, the fact that the pro-life movement offers all these options, crisis pregnancy centers. I always love talking about the Sisters of Life for our hometown team here in New York, who Cardinal O'Connor said, if you're a pregnant woman who needs help, come to the Catholic Church. And his answer to what are we going to do when you knock on the door was the Sisters of Life. But also people think, and the Knights of Columbus just put out new polling. They've been doing it for 11 years, commissioning polling from Marist, where it's clear that most people who describe themselves as pro-choice are not, their cause in life is not abortion. They just want to know that a woman in a difficult situation has options. But they also, they ask smart questions, and it's not just the Knights of Columbus polling that show us this. People have no idea that abortion is legal in all trimesters in the United States, you know? And most want restrictions.
The moves on the pro-life movement, if you include that Supreme Court case from a few months ago, when they took down that requirement that the counseling centers have to make a statement about abortion options
right.
providers, saying you can't force them
right.
to be, is this part of the momentum? I mean, did that decision reverberate through the pro-life world
yeah,
as
no,
saying
yeah.
this? You know, this court may be on our side a little bit.
It was encouraging in that regard because it gave you some hope. And but the other thing is just the mere fact, frankly, even if you lost, obviously that would be a huge setback. But the fact of a Supreme Court case means that you have all the, you know, you have a day, but you have more than a day of media attention to the fact that there are pro-life centers. And so that was just a great opportunity in itself. I mean, the Washington Post wrote pieces that you don't expect the Washington to publish pieces that you don't expect them to. And it was a win all around.
What I like, I mean, not what I like, but I think what helps in a case like that is to show that the popular presentation of the pro-life movement as the bullies, the people who want to control things, the balance of aggression is pretty strongly on the other side.
Yeah.
When do abortion centers, do Planned Parenthood clinics have to have a statement on the wall advising
right.
visitors there? This is where you can go for pro-life counseling and,
right.
and so on. It's pretty one way.
Right.
And I sometimes wonder when you get something like the anger of the counter-protesters, where again, the bullying is the balance of anger is squarely on one side, that deep down secretly they are very defensive
mm-hmm.
because they know they're wrong. They know there's something wrong. Or maybe they said, this is a compromise that we have made
mm-hmm.
and we can't help feeling some ambiguity, moral ambiguity, over what we are representing. And one way you overcome that is you get
down.
Angry.
Right.
You get more forceful.
Right.
You push harder because you sense a threat inside yourselves. I mean, I'm you know, this is armchair psychology.
Right, right.
But I it just seems something's going on inside them.
There was so every month down in Soho, here in Manhattan, there's first Saturday of the month, there's a mass at Old St. Patrick's, and then a prayerful procession to the flagship Planned Parenthood, down Margaret Sanger Place is what it's called, right next to the Sheen Center. So a couple months ago, it was like the 10th anniversary of them doing this. And I was at the mass, and I get out of my Uber, and all of a sudden before mass, this is at 7:45 in the morning, it was an 8 o'clock mass. There are protesters outside the mass, counter protesters.
Protesting a mass.
And I will never forget. So they're protesting throughout the mass. The doors are closed, but you can hear them. And it wasn't a huge crowd again, but very loud, very angry. I'm going up to receive communion, and I'm behind two Sisters of Life, and I hear them screaming outside, "Pro-life is a lie. You don't care if women die." As these two beautiful women who have dedicated their lives to this cause receiving their Lord in the Eucharist. Anyway. That's where we are, and it's obviously it's sick, it's poisonous, it's
hauling the little Sisters of the Poor before the Supreme Court. That they don't care if women die. Is the administration, is Trump's social policy, is there anything material going on in Trump's social policy around this other than just giving support, speaking at March for Life and representing?
The thing is, this administration is staffed with some people who are true believers who are rewriting regulations I think when the story is told of this administration, it is not what a lot of people would have predicted on these issues. People who really understand religious liberty and what the challenges are, and they made it a calculation to go over. In some cases, frankly, people who weren't supporters of Trump during the election who realized, you know, this is a huge opportunity and we should take this opportunity.
And to me, it seemed like a lot of social conservative voters had just finally said, "We've heard promises."
Mm-hmm.
We've seen very good people,
right?
Who were on our side, but when they got in that chair,
they just
went soft. They didn't go against us, but this time it was almost seeing, when you look at the threat from the other side, and again the increased aggression of the Democratic Party, from casting it as the war on women. Pro-life is war on women, and all women should be like Julia in the Life of Julia video. If our listeners don't know, just type in Life of Julia, the Obama campaign video. Extraordinary.
And as I recall, Yuval Levin had a great article in National Review on that too. You could watch that, read that.
Yes.
You don't want to give them the click.
I think the Life of Julia proceeds. She has her career. She has her education. Her career. She has a child, and I don't think a man ever pops up in that video.
Yeah, that
her partner
might be
is the federal government.
Right.
And that's the provider.
Right.
So, but if you do look at the march this week, what are there specific things you would like to see come out of this year's March for Life?
Well, you know,
I mean, apart from simply we're marching for life.
Right.
We're showing we are strong, we are firm, and here is what we believe, and we're still going to, no matter what happens in politics.
I'll be honest with you, I don't always go to the rally part, and I've always thought that's sort of the least important part of it. And I know people are getting up in arms, people get up in arms, and I understand I actually have an interview with Charlie Camosi, the Fordham professor on National Review this week. And he's a pro-life Democrat, and he isn't happy Ben Shapiro's speaking because he's such a sort of lightning rod commentator, and Donald Trump. And, you know, I think the March for Life makes calculations that that will help with press coverage, and I understand those calculations. Mm-hmm. I don't think the rally is the most important thing, and the things that are said at the rally are the most important thing. I think, first and foremost, it's a pilgrimage for both a civil and religious pilgrimage for most of these kids who are going. It's important for them to get on buses and be uncomfortable and be joyful anyway, and they mm-hmm. are. And it's really cool to see, and they're normal kids, and so I want to see that and
right.
and have adults be there and be energized by that. I just got back from Indianapolis. It's a couple of days now, but the Fellowship of Catholic University Students Focus had their big Sikh conference that they do every 2 years. And there were over 17,000 kids in their 20s and Muslim college students. And they're just, again, they're just like normal kids who love God and want that to mean something in their lives, you know? And they see young couples around, and it's just a really encouraging thing. And it's sort of the opposite of what you see when you check Twitter, you know?
Right, right.
Or
youth culture, this is the reprieve.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And they're happy. I'm sure they are very, very happy to be in a place like that.
Yeah, I know. And they want, I was really moved. I talked about sort of mercy in the public square, I think was my talk. And all these kids came up to me afterward who were converts, who said, you know, I'm really struggling with how to talk to my family. I want to share, but I don't want to do damage to our relationship because it's already done down, you know, kind of thing. And they really just, they want to be a balm in the culture. They really want to, you know, in, right. in non-idealistic, you know, pie-in-the-sky kinds of way, they really want to help.
Right.
You know, and that's what I want to see. I want people to see that, what I get to see every year.
You know, I hope we get on our website some testimonials, people who attended, mm-hmm. and young ones in particular who want to write and witness.
I try to show as many pictures of smiling kids and, you know, tell their one-line stories on Twitter, or just sort of...
Right. Well, this gets back to the issue from before. Pro-life is a positive, affirming. It's something you can openly commit to. You feel good about what you're doing.
It's
and you
the
can say pro-choice.
Armchair psychology, right? Of the other side.
Right.
What could be more life-giving than to be supporting not what is deemed a war on women, but protecting human life, celebrating human life, you know?
Exactly.
And really loving, one thing that I've been struck by in the last couple of years, and maybe this is because we see hope on the horizon, there's so much more talk of all right, so what does this look like after the birth? You know, what is pro-life
right.
policy to support families?
Right, right.
So that we truly do have healthy policies from cradle to grave, you know.
And I think that you've seen in the last few months this push to make the abortion, to remove all shame or all guilt or all complication. The T-shirts,
shout
proud to have had an abortion, shout out your abortion. And I'm thinking about this, look, this isn't gonna work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a family, you had an abortion, then you had another child. Do you want your surviving child to see that T-shirt?
Right.
You mean I could have had a brother or a sister?
Right, right.
I mean, this is not going to work.
Right, right.
To me, is that desperation?
Right.
Are they at the point of desperation?
I think so. You know, I mean, frankly, if they weren't, Brett Kavanaugh would not be on the Supreme Court, because there was a moment there where they could have had public opinion before they went. They started throwing every allegation and really being extremist in questioning. they could have won that fight. But the fact that they're not self-aware enough to realize that and to dial things back, like Hillary Clinton in the election,
so they might have
desperation.
If they, it's interesting. If they had just taken the Ford question and just said, you know, we've got to, they might have pulled Susan Collins over.
I think that's very plausible.
They would have pulled Flake. They would have. Maybe Manchin. We would have lost Manchin.
I think that's very plausible. But they were so
bloodthirsty.
And it was close. And if they hadn't thrown all those other allegations out there, I don't know if he'd be on the Supreme Court. I think it would have played out a lot differently.
Kevin, thank you for being with us. And you're on your way. You're going to get on a train today and head down. So I'll tell our readers to check the National Review website to get Catherine's after March and during the March reporting.
Yeah, and not only mine. We'll have a number of people there. So
excellent.
We'll have something to read.
Thank you.
Thank you.